Welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. Check out our website at www.thewildernessmedic.com.
Expedition resources, wilderness medicine blog, and much more.
Hi, so welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. My name's Daniel. Today I'm really pleased to be joined by David Tamale Sali, who we first sort of met each other via various forums, I think, online, and getting involved with your project, the Medic SOS project, which we'll come to later. David had a surprising sort of path in and out of medical school, doing many different things. Welcome on. Welcome to the podcast. And we're going to have, an interesting chat today, particularly looking at, I suppose, the insights you've gained, looking at sort of more like burnout, things like that, and how we can kind of address that. So, yeah, welcome.
Thank you, Daniel. Thanks for having me.
No, not at all. I guess let's start by just kind of covering a bit of background, because you've had an interesting path sort of into medical school, then out doing various other things, and then I believe sort of back into medical school more recently and things, and then sort of leading us up to now. But maybe if you can give us a bit of a summary, sort of how you've got to where we are now.
Yeah, sure. I'll give you the short version. But at the start, I'm not a qualified medical doctor. Neither do I play one on TV. Just to clarify that up front. But I have been in and out of medical school and medical things for the better part of the last, I guess, 24 years or so. So I started off in Cardiff Medical School. But I think, let me start here. I don't know if you had this experience or if any of the listeners had this, but my dad's a doctor. And so I grew up as the son of a doctor, as son of an African doctor, and one who's a consultant, extremely successful. And when I was a kid, maybe 8 years old, the life plan was go to school, become a doctor, and then you can do whatever you want. And okay. I did really well, pretty well in school. That was quite clear, and it seemed to tick all the boxes. Thinking, oh, this is great, and I had heroes like Albert Schweitzer. You know, just being a doctor seemed like a good thing. I'd impress, you know, get the approval of my dad. It was just, and I did well in school. I got good marks in the different subjects. There's a lot of support for, you know, math, sciences. I loved English. I loved writing. I loved music, and that was okay, but it was okay in the context of the plan, which is to be a doctor, and fit things in.
Yeah.
That was the pitch, and I went all in on it. And so I went from, you know, I was born in the UK, then spent some years in Kuwait, then there's the Gulf War, then I was in Uganda for primary school, and back in Kuwait for GCSEs and A-levels. I'm just remembering the path. But that's just for context. I didn't just fit in one box, but the plan was still very straightforward. And then I managed to get into Cardiff University to study medicine. It was University of Wales College of Medicine at the time. And it was, I tell people that the studying was the easiest bit. The difficult bit was being pulled in and out of lectures, because my status was, I am a British citizen and everyone in the accounts department agreed except for one person. She made the final decision saying he should pay the disease fee. So it was, instead of a grand a year, it was 9 grand a year for the first 2 years and then 18 grand for each year after that. So I didn't have that money. And so I was in and out. And then so I was set to resit my third year of med school, September 2003. And then that's when I had the meeting where he said, sorry, David, we're going to have to discontinue. And I think I put it on my LinkedIn profile. That's where I went to the pathology department. There was a cubicle there, and I just, toilet cubicle, and I just went in and I just cried, because I never failed anything. Yeah, it was just, and this was also the lifetime was coming to an end. Yeah. And, you know, who am I now? Mm-hmm. What am I going to do? So I spent a lot of time I tried to get back into med school. I'd written to others. But my first job after that, I think first couple of jobs. First one was working in the laminating press. And this was, you know, there's a lot of shame with, David got kicked out of med school. I'd managed to get in with your identity tied up in always achieving and getting really good marks. So it's failure and also being out of step with your peers, because the plan was we would all be finishing at the same time, matching at the same time. We'd had a lecture about the new matching system back in 2003 as it was. So you've got your hopes and dreams set on being with friends. So so I was suddenly no longer part of that. And you know, my friends, you know, they still talk to me, but their interests were on, you know, what's the placement going to be? Sorry, we can't meet up this. So I was out of sync with my peers. And so then I got a job out of, my first job was, you know, just to try and pay rent, was laminating football cards, I think at, I think Leeds United football concert. I just went to the student union, got it. I wasn't really into, you know, football that much at the time, but I thought, okay, let me get this job. I think I managed a day, like 12 hours. It was marvelous work. And I was thinking, how is this going to give me time to think about what the next thing is? And then I went to a party at some point, and there was a friend of mine, Trish, and she was saying, Sally, what are you doing? You should do what I said. This is what I'm doing. He said, do what I'm doing. Taking notes. I said, really? What's that? And he said, you're a medical student. I summarize notes and I get paid £900 an hour, whatever it was. So I never even heard of that. So then an opportunity came, and then I managed to get a job. I was actually in the public library, just that was my office, where I would just be trying to figure out, you know, what am I going to do, reading books. End up reading a lot of business books and copywriting. I don't know how, but somehow I got into it. At the time, and then I suddenly had a very strong feeling that I needed to go to the GP surgery next to my house where I lived. So that I got up and I just ran, because I thought I need to be there before they closed. I didn't know anything about their hours. Went there and said I need to see the practice manager, and they said, do you have an appointment? No. And so the practice manager came. I said who I was. Said, I'm here for the job of summarizing notes. I was a third year medical student, etc. So the practice manager showed me around, said, okay, we're not doing that yet. The GP contract is looking at going into this, but we'll keep your details on file. So meeting, and then, but I knew there was another one next to my house. And so I ran to that one and, you know, said the same thing. I'm here and I'm here for this job. Do you have an appointment? No. Practice manager came. I told my story. She said, we've just had a meeting, like I think an hour or two ago, to say we need to recruit someone for this job. So I'd shown up the same day that they said they needed to hire a medical student. They'd agreed on it, and I happened to show up. I share that where it's relevant, because that was like an impulse. There wasn't anything advertised. I didn't know what I was doing. I think one of the things that we don't get taught enough to do, but maybe you find in, you know, in practice, you get hunches about things. You get instincts about things.
For sure, yeah.
And probably more so when you're doing wilderness medicine, that there's at a certain level, everyone has the same basic training. At a certain level, the sign is infective endocarditis. Everyone can see it. But then so you kind of remove the training as a variable. And then you see there's that instinct of, let me ask this question. Or I wonder about, and so those kinds of, I wonder if such and such, that's actually there's a lot more wisdom in it than we get taught about, because I don't think you can really teach it. You can just nurture it. So that was how I got to
the idea of medicine being an art as well as science, maybe, by those kind of hunches and that sort of general idea, isn't it? And then, so you did that, and then sort of worked through various other options, and then you ended up getting, sort of in your bio, you say, blackmailed by your dad into going back to medical school again.
Yes. So what so this was 2014. My wife and I got married 2008. And so we moved out to Uganda. I mean, this is a short story, of course, but we moved to Uganda. The idea being my family was there and we could have family, and we were estranged from my wife's family at the time. And so we were going to move to Uganda and be with family just to help us settle. I was working as a copywriter at the time. And so I said to my dad, you know, this is, we feel we need to move. But we'll be starting over. He said, don't worry. We've got a job for you. We've got housing. We've got all sorts of things, because he was doing really well with his clinics and hospitals there. So we did that, went all in on moving to Uganda. And then I think it was within a couple of months or so that my dad said, I'm not going to pay you to work in the hospital anymore. I will pay you if you go back to med school. And if you're not going to do that, good luck to you and your family, in effect.
Wow.
So I was kind of caught out. I'd never anticipated that. And I'd left my job in Cardiff. We'd sent all our stuff to Uganda, and it didn't arrive for another, I think, 18 months or so to arrive. And so I was in a bind, and also not realizing that at the time there was still, medicine still had a pull. There was a lot of shame with, around not being a doctor. So even when, yes, when I worked as a copywriter, or everything was measured by, this has to be at least as good as if I was still a doctor, or this has to be at least as impressive. And that was a subconscious thing I didn't really face up to until quite recently.
So do you think a lot of that was coming from the family pressures that you were saying, sort of since you're 8 years old, a lot of that sort of expectation almost? Because I'm sure lots of people will have experienced that similar sort of, you know, ending up in a certain career because that's the expectation. You know, your dad or your mum does that career, so therefore you're doing it. And that's a lot to live up for, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And there's a joke, I think there's a stand-up comedian who I saw one time on TV, and she was saying, she's from Nigeria, former engineer, and she said, in African families, there are four jobs that you're allowed to have. It's a doctor, engineer, lawyer, and disgrace to the family. So it's it's couched as a joke, but it's, I think, the things that maybe are not PC to talk about, or there's not space created for them. The role that culture plays in, it's invisible. I mean, you have a workplace culture, but also the culture of where you come from. So I know that my experience, and talking to people from other African families, lots of Asian families, that expectation. And it's similar to the, if you ask different people, where did it come from? We probably wouldn't be able to put our finger on it, but it exists as a real force to contend with. So there was a lot of shame. And I think a lot of that shame played into self-sabotage or not really succeeding. So it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. See, you should have been a doctor because you're not really making it happen.
Do you think a lot of these ideas then kind of came into developing the Medic SOS project to sort of support other people who feel in similar positions? Or did that kind of come from somewhere else, or kind of a mixture of things?
I don't know if it's too soon to go into Medic SOS, but in terms of the ideas about shame and about, I remember in third year when I was just feeling a lot of frustration and we were starting to get into clinical medicine. So I would joke with my classmates. I'd say, which would you rather be, a doctor or a TV doctor? I think at the time there was ER, so it was, would you rather be so-and-so
or
ER?
George Clooney or something.
Really, George Clooney, or you, JD, would you rather actually be a doctor, or would you rather be paid to be a doctor? So these are kinds of questions I'd be asking my classmates. And the responses were, so this is my unofficial surveying of people.
And so I
get different responses. And I also noticed that when we did the different rotations, that different doctors would say, don't do it. And so some of them would laugh and they'd be, oh, yeah. And but we were the medical students gathering around the case and hoping that we knew the answer to whatever the consultant was going to ask, and hoping not to be embarrassed. And a lot of it was shame management or embarrassment management. And it's less about, I'm studying something that's going to help the patient. Of course we were. But in terms of day-to-day practical, you know, brass tacks, it's, I hope I don't get embarrassed because I don't remember the Krebs cycle. Little things like that drive you and go, phew, they didn't pick me. Or they picked me for the thing that I happened to have read the night before from Kumar and Clark.
So
when you have that as the driving thing, as in the reality of what's going on in your head, alongside things like shame, alongside, if I don't do this, my dad will be ashamed of me. If I don't do this, how am I going to, when I meet with my relatives, my brothers doing success, more successful, or I'm the only one to get into med school. Dad went through all of this stuff to make us, you know, there's a lot of guilt and shame over sacrifices made. So obligation.
Yeah.
Remember one time I was in college and there was a vicar who used to be a dentist and he died. So we were at the, we'd gone to church and we then went to the house of his widow, who was a doctor, a radiologist. And I remember just, you know, being in the line and saying, "I'm so sorry for your loss." And then in the middle of the line, she says, "David, finish med school." I just, like, out of nowhere, just, and it wasn't out of nowhere, but that had been a conversation. And so it became the equivalent of the dying wish of so-and-so was that you finish. So then that was used by family on me. And I say that in case anyone listening has had those experiences, but where do you even bring that up in a meeting on Monday morning?
Yeah.
That this is driving my decision. You feel embarrassed. You feel, you know, suck it up, so-and-so. And then there's always that comparison thing where you can find a case that's much worse than you, somebody who was blind with one leg, lost all sudden, and then they became a doctor. And so that's used to kind of like Boggle. I don't know if you played the game Boggle. That whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever else you get, if they've got it, it's like, nope, irrelevant, next. But that's not how life works. And I think there are people who struggle with burnout in any area. If you feel unable to say, this is bothering me for this reason, and not need to justify it, but have someone listen to you, I think that's really important. So I think I just was attuned to that because of the frustration of just trying to get through medical, finding this resistance. So I started looking around and being aware of my own thoughts and feelings. So yeah, I think that's, those are the seeds that led to Medic SOS eventually.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because I think, that whole concept of shame, guilt, letting, you know, either peers or family members down is something that stops people from potentially leaving medicine or talking to people about, you know, these issues, doesn't it? Because I think there is still a lot of, there's obviously that sort of prestige factor potentially, and then, you know, various people have either, you know, spent time putting you in this position to become a doctor, and actually it isn't for everyone, and particularly when you're sort of starting off 18, 19, you don't know what you really want to do. It's impossible, isn't it? And and then you suddenly got on this conveyor belt, and then you're sort of thinking, well, actually, you know what, this is you know, going back to the TV doctor analogy, maybe it's not quite like that. But I think that whole shame thing makes it really hard for people to sort of talk about it. And the Medic SOS project, for people who don't know, do you want to just briefly say a bit about what that is, I suppose, and sort of how it's progressed since you came up with the idea?
Yeah. So in November last year, I was on the private Facebook group, Medic Footprints, I think is the proper name. But I was subscribed to that, and they do really good work in supporting people finding alternative careers. So I would just be there, kind of just hanging out and encouraging people where I could. And somebody posted something anonymously, and the youngest was going to bed, and I just saw it, and I saw, oh, this person is really struggling. So I don't always comment on posts because somebody else is better qualified to, or said something, I have nothing to add. I'll just, you know, like it and just second what's there. But I saw the post, so I just immediately just wrote whatever, the first thing that came out, said, right, stop, breathe, and just walk them through as if I was walking them off a ledge. And said, this is what you need to do. And then they're feeling financially overwhelmed. They said, here's what you need to do. Broke it down, and it just was instinctive. This is what you need to do to survive being in this moment. Mm-hmm. This is a chance to change perspective and so on. So I did that, posted it, and the person responded positively, and other people responded to it. So I thought, oh, I wonder if I could get this insight from other people, and maybe see at the back of my mind is also real medics. I've caught people who are qualified doctors because there's that feeling of being an imposter where I'm speaking, but I don't have the title doctor. And if you don't have the certain credentials, you feel the shame again, saying, who am I to contribute something? But I have something to contribute. I've survived.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm continuing to survive all sorts of the things that the person was describing.
Posted
that and got a positive response. And then I shared an idea. I said, well, I wonder if I can put a book together. So I made up a name. Medic SOS was just, I made it up and said, Medic SOS, 100, you know, real life medics sharing what they've done to survive burnout, put it in a book. Then it doesn't have to just be me or my perspective. It can be perspectives from lots of different people. So what I'm sharing may not resonate with you or somebody else, but somebody, you know, your perspective might resonate. You know, we're different and we're in different seasons, so we have different things to contribute.
Yeah.
And so that got a positive response. So I thought, okay, I've done this before in different areas, this idea of contacting people and, again, using copywriting, you know, just writing emails, contacting people, and being able to, I guess, convince people that, and I'll share an idea and it'll get people to say, yeah, we like that. So I've done that before. And so I thought, I wonder if it'll work in this area. So, but instead of just doing it, which is what I've done in the past, I thought, okay, there's a chance to just walk it through step by step, saying, I've got an idea. What do you think? And then they say, yeah, this is great. It's 16 likes. So then I said, okay, here's the title. Here's the idea to raise £10,000 for charities that are already helping physicians struggling with burnout, depression, and suicide. Which charities would you recommend? So then that got people involved. Again, it's not a million likes. It was, you know, a handful of people, just if you're saying a sort of coffee with someone. That was enough. Okay. Put together a Google form. A few days later, posted on the same form. Said, right, it's happening. Here's the form. If you want to be part of it, here you go. And so I posted the form there and everywhere I could. And then started using LinkedIn to just reach out to people, Facebook. And yeah, it just took off from there, just reaching out to people who read the description, when I put this in the introduction to the book, just it took 46 days. It was the fastest project.
Pretty impressive, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. How were you surprised by the response and how many people sort of bought into that idea and kind of identified with it?
Do you say how was I surprised? Or?
Were you surprised by sort of the response you got from that? And because you said obviously it was a really quick turnaround and lots of people keen to sort of contribute, I suppose.
Well, I was surprised because I've done projects like this before and it could take a year, 2 years. Some of them I haven't even completed because I've got forms for different projects. But I was surprised that I was doing this in November, so people are already winding down for the year. I'm doing it, reaching out to medics who are very busy in their spare time. What are they going to do with their spare time? Top of the list is not respond to a request from a stranger. Above all the things already on their plate. And then seeing you and the others who generously just took a moment to respond. I said, 61 seconds. I didn't need an hour. I didn't need 5 minutes. It's just, what's the first thing that comes to mind? And there was the speed of the response, and people have responded since after the book's come out and said, sorry, I was busy with such and such. Really liked the book. Keep going. Showed me that this is an important issue that people are aware of,
and to
just pitch in what they could. And even those who aren't in the book, it just showed me that the same thing I learned when I was working in the doctor's surgery, reading people's notes, that experience opened my mind because I would walk around on the streets of Cardiff looking at people, some of whom whose medical notes I've been reading through, or Professor so-and-so, and everything, of course, is confidential. But my awareness as a human being was expanded. So even where I couldn't talk about specifics, it showed me that quotation is true. I don't remember the reference, but it's something like, be kind to everyone you meet, because everyone you meet is fighting a battle far worse than you realize. And maybe paraphrasing it slightly, but it showed me that regardless of title, probably especially those with titles where you would see they don't seem as if they have everything. They might be struggling most and feel unable to say anything because there are many people, they say, okay, I should feel grateful. So I was surprised, by the speed, but I wasn't surprised that there was any response because I saw how one person had responded to my off-the-cuff thoughts. And I know this is an issue. It's been an issue for decades. Just something that's not prioritized because whether it's, you know, there's strikes, there's, but whatever the issue, there's always something more pressing to talk about.
That's right, isn't it? And it always seems that the answer is talk about it, but it's finding that time in a struggling healthcare service, I guess. And what were some of the main themes that you got back from contributors in terms of, you know, the advice that came out of the book?
Well, I was thinking about it the other day, and I actually have created I thought, what is the summary? Because I knew, you know, talking about the book, I thought, I read through it, made notes, had several pages of notes. I thought, can I sum it up into one page? And so I did a one-page summary, but I had a checklist of things. And one of the biggest things is to do with this thing of shame. It's a common thing in the book is you're not alone. It's not weakness to get help. It's actually strength, which it's one thing to hear it, but the structures around us, the people around us, don't necessarily reinforce that message. So trying to break it down further, saying it's normal to get help, and this is what was said on repeat. There's nothing, you're not alone. It's saying that the rest of us are struggling with this as well. The rest of us have had help. The rest of us are okay because we have help or we're receiving help. It's, you don't have to try and figure it out on your own. So that's a constant thing. It's so simple to say, but I know that the lived experience can be, you can just brush it off because you think, no, my identity is part of the medic. It's like, no, you're a human being first. And I don't know how to get under the skin of someone listening to this, but what I saw from people from around the world, different backgrounds, I was seeing how there's literally hundreds of years of medical experience in this book. Just, you know, if basically 5 years times 101 people, it's like you have hundreds of years of different, and that's just basic training, let alone, you know, people have gone on to different specialities. But the constant thing is, this is the problem is not with you. And it's not wrong to be struggling with something. You are, in as much as you will help your patients, you are a patient as well. You are worthy of help. You are not, it doesn't make you weak, it makes you a human being to need support, to need help. We're not designed to do life by ourselves. And many circumstances make it be the case where somebody is struggling. There's, you know, and different doctors who have committed suicide because they've been, you know, overworked. And the labels of health service and the political conversations are less useful for getting at the root of it, because then people can be distracted by, well, we're doing the best we can. No, we're not talking about that. Mm-hmm. It's saying you as a human being in your specific situation, regardless of what it looks like and regardless of how much worse it could be or how much better it is than it used to be, if a patient isn't getting enough insulin, it doesn't matter that they used to get enough insulin. You give them what they need. If you diagnose that this is what the patient needs, you fix the problem. And that's what I'm seeing with this, that if somebody can just feel it's normal to get help, it's normal to go and talk to someone about, you know, what are my options? Now, I'm not really happy with where I am, despite spending 15 years getting here. Yeah, I'm having trouble letting go of the sunk costs of working hard to be a GP. Really, I want to be in radiology, or really, I want to be a baker. I don't know how to get from here to there. Not intellectually. And it's not all or nothing. That's why I wanted to reach out to people who are doctors, people who are not, no longer doctors, people who are part-time, people who are full-time. Because when somebody feels hopeless, because they think they have no option, but I wanted people to see, not just from what's said, but from clicking on the links of the authors, you see, you have so much you can do. You can play with this thing. If you're already a doctor, but you don't want to use it, that's fine. If you want to do something and it has to use medicine, you can. But it's just saying that you have more options than you realize, And that can give you hope. And if you have hope, then you can look around and see, what could I do? What would make life bearable? It might be, I want to have a 3-day weekend. That might be enough. It might be just 5 minutes. It's the same thing when you do bloods for a patient. You find that with all the major symptoms that are showing up, the issue is to do with magnesium levels. It's an electrolyte balance, which can sound, and the quantities involved are so tiny, but you address it and it's a massive change. And so it's that level of diligence and due diligence on yourself as a person. If you were diagnosing yourself, if you were your own patient and using the force of your awareness and your training and the training of others, and you know, we have multidisciplinary teams for dealing with patients, not dealing with, but dealing with the cases presented by patients.
Yeah.
Why not do that with ourselves? And so that's a peer group, that's, you know, somebody, you know, there are lots of coaches in the book who give free consultation.
Yeah.
You don't lose anything. Make a phone call, click a link,
yeah,
and get some help. And it's not saying that the situation is supposed to change. You might say, well, this can't change overnight. It doesn't. Let's start the conversation. It's really the hope.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
getting all the different insights. Sorry. It's what I saw was just, you're not alone. You're part of a community. And one size doesn't fit all, but we can figure this out together.
Yeah, I think that's such amazing and inspiring advice, isn't it? And it's like you say, it's getting that awareness and knowing you're not alone, and that there are options out there for different people. And I'll put a link to your website and the book and things on the description for the podcast. It's been really great to talk to you. I found it really fascinating, and it all comes back to that sort of theme that you were saying at the start, wasn't it, shame, which is, yeah, it's unfortunately, it is a taboo, isn't it? It's a difficult thing to talk about, but I think you've shown through the discussion we've had that it is something that hopefully people are getting a bit more comfortable about talking about, isn't it, and identifying. But yeah, it's working at how we kind of manage that within stretched healthcare systems, isn't it? But I think the fact that you had such a good response and we've now got that, a really nice platform to sort of build upon. And I think that element of creating an MDT for yourself and having that community is really powerful. So thank you so much for joining me. And it's been really interesting. And I hope you've enjoyed it as well.
I have, Daniel. Thank you very much. And one parting thought, because I was listening, you got some really great episodes on your podcast. And I created for the book a checklist that I'll add to it as that people can use. But it's not about the checklist. It's the encouragement that when people are listening to your podcast, they're really good ideas that people are sharing. And my encouragement is, if something resonates, just take one step immediately. Even if it's just to email yourself and say, need to take a step on such and such, or post it on, so, you know, the podcast you did with Sophia about moral injury was really good. But just to encourage your listeners that if you get an insight, same as I had that instinct to go and run to the GP surgery, whatever, those insights are more full of more wisdom, and you realize if you'll just take the tiniest step in response to something you get, don't worry about the whole staircase. Just take the first step, and then you'll see that leads to the next and the next. And I think that's something that people can take away with them. Just take action on something right now that has stood out to you.
If you've enjoyed listening to our podcast, then check out our website, www.thewildernessmedic.com. If you're interested in being a guest on a future episode or writing a blog for us, then do get in touch, and don't forget to follow us on social media. Until next time, take care.